So welcome back to Curious Questions with me, Ricky Williams. And my guest today comes from the world of sports journalism to be exact. His name is Bomani Jones. You might recognize him from ESPN for several years, and or at least for a few years, where I got to know Bomani was on a show with my friend Dan Le Batard called Highly Questionable. After that, he actually got his own show at ESPN called High Noon. And I'm sure if you haven't seen any of those shows, but you watch ESPN, you've seen him on Around the Horn, as he's often a guest on that. And I think that's really where Bomani became famous or became known, because he kept winning the Around the Horn. So obviously a very intelligent man, African-American sports journalist on ESPN. As we know, there aren't a whole lot of those. And so I'm really interested in getting to the bottom of Bomani's story. Let's get into his astrology a little bit. And it's an interesting case here because Bomani is what astrologers call a double Virgo, okay? And when we say double, it means we're talking about the primal triad, okay? Review session here, the primal triad in astrology, the sun, the moon, and what we call the ascendant. So really the core of who a person is. Astrology, there's a whole bunch more. But if you really can grasp and understand the primal triad, you're going to get a really good sense of who this person is. And so again, sun, moon, and ascendant. For Bomani, he is a Virgo, and he is a Virgo rising, okay? And his moon is in Pisces, okay? What's interesting about this is, in an astrological chart, when the moon and the sun oppose each other, the same way when they're opposite each other here on Earth, we call it a full moon. And so Bomani was born on a full moon. The significance is signs that oppose each other represent two sides of the same coin. Things that they have something in common, but they exist at opposite sides of the spectrum. And so the Virgo side of the spectrum, you know, two of the primal triad in Virgo, so that we're probably going to see more of this in his characters, is Virgo. And Virgo is about competence, all right? And, you know, to make it to ESPN, to be on television nationally talking about sports, you have to show competence. The other thing I noticed about Bomani from looking at his Wikipedia page is that both of his parents were college professors. And this is also part of Virgo. Part of the Virgo archetypal field is about lineage, meaning systems, bodies of knowledge, systems of information being passed down from one generation to the next. And interesting, Bomani has two master's degrees, okay? His mother was a professor of economics, and Bomani has a master's degree in economics. His father was a professor in political science, and Bomani has a master's degree in politics. So lineage, right? Passing on information. You see it's obvious here. And now to the moon in Pisces, okay? And so Virgo and Earth sign is about competence on the earthly plane, right? Being good at something that is tangible, right? That is useful to other people, okay? Pisces is about our connection to other realms. It's about rising above, being caught up in details and competence and seeing the bigger picture. And so the symbolism we get when there's a full moon, the sun and the moon are opposite, is it feels like the sun represents more of our mind and our head, and the moon represents our heart. And so the head and the heart, you know, are have two different agendas. And part of the journey is making sure that both of those agendas are dealt with. And I'm curious to see how that's manifesting, how that's showing up in Bomani's chart. So let's get to it. Let's bring him on and ask him some curious questions. I want to welcome you, Bomani, onto the show. You know, we have a mutual friend, Dan Le Batard. And, you know, Dan speaks very highly of you. And I first, you know, found you watching Highly Questionable. And so
okay.
I'm sure, you know, we'll get into talking about Dan a little bit. But the nature of the show is a lot of people don't know, but I'm really into astrology. And so the nature of the show is I bring guests on, I get their birth information, look at the chart, and I use that information to guide my my questions. And so do you have any experience or any experience with astrology at all?
I am not like the super duper biggest astrology guy. And it's kind of interesting because I first became familiar with you, you know, when you were playing with at Texas. Dwight Kirkpatrick played linebacker for y'all. He went to high school with me.
Oh, you're from Houston. Yeah.
And I must be a really big Ricky Williams fan because I'm actually about to sit up here and indulge the sun, moon, and stars and everything else and see where it goes.
I appreciate it. So you're open to it.
Yeah, man. I'll let it ride. Let's see where it goes.
Okay. But I'm sure you know that you're a Virgo, right?
Yes. Yeah, I got that much. That's all I got.
And have you ever like read anything about Virgo or been in a or any kind of something? Usually a woman kind of tell you about Virgos or anything like that?
Yeah, I know a decent bit. Like, I'm not the greatest at rattling it off, but I do find that when I look at the descriptions of Virgos, that it does kind of fit. And I'm a little bit cuspy, I believe. My birthday is August 26th, so I'm like almost on the other one.
Yeah.
And yeah, it, I got to say, some of it seems to match up.
Yeah. So I mean, I obviously, to me, the moment where I kind of have a sense of somebody and they're coming on and then I look at the chart, it's like opening a gift, right? Because to me, I look at astrology as kind of helping you see like what's underneath the surface. Okay. And so Virgo, right? You said the sun, the moon, and the stars. Okay. And so in astrology, we look at the sun. We also look at the moon. Okay. And
gotcha. And
when you were born, you were born on a full moon. I don't know if you knew that. And the significance of a full moon is that when there's a full moon at sunset, if you look to the east, you'll see the sun setting. And at the same time, if you look to the west, you'll see the moon rising. And so the full moon, the moon and the sun are opposite each other. Okay.
Okay.
And so in astrology, the sun represents our identity, right? Our outward identity. This is who I am. And one of the archetypes with Virgo is the scholar and the critic. Okay. The critic. And I'll talk more about that. Okay. So this idea of you know, you self-identifying as a critic, as a scholar, and as someone who has a passion for learning, all right? And then the moon, okay? The moon is in the opposite sign, right? It's opposing the opposite sign. So the opposite sign represents an opposite principle. And so the nature of people who were born on a full moon, their head, right? Their idea of themselves is going in one direction, and their heart, the way they feel, is going in a different direction. And so sometimes full moon people, they feel this sense of being torn, okay? And so now the sun is in Virgo, which you already know. Your moon when you were born was in the sign of Pisces, okay? Pisces, all right? And if I had to whittle those two principles down to one word, Virgo, I would choose competence, okay? Competence, being useful, developing a skill that's useful to other people, right? And it brings in the idea of the Virgo attention to detail. Okay. I also like the craftsperson for Virgo, right? Someone who approaches their craft with that attention to detail and this strive towards perfection, not to be perfect, but the striving towards getting it right, towards perfection. Okay. That's Virgo. And it's an earth sign. So it's about how do I make myself useful on this earthly plane? Okay. Pisces is the one word is transcendence. Okay. This is spiritual symbolism. Like, and this is the interesting part about your chart is there's a lot of spiritual symbolism that shows up in your chart. Okay. A lot. And when I use the word spiritual, I don't mean strictly religious. I mean, again, the word is transcendence. I mean, this need to disconnect and connect to some kind of inspiration, to connect to some kind of bigger picture. Okay. And so to sum it up, I'm saying, you know, your son, one part of you really wants to be good at something, right? That's useful and other people appreciate. The moon, right? It more wants to tap into the imagination, right? Tap into the imagination and look at these deeper narratives, okay? These deeper narratives, what's really going on in this. And that's what I mean by spiritual. To me, spirit is what connects all of us, okay? What connects all of us, all right? And you and I have some similarities in our chart, okay? And so you said the sun, the moon, and the stars. The stars that you're referring to, we call the rising sign or the ascendant. And it represents what constellation, what group of stars was rising in the east at the time and place of your birth. And it represents how we dawn on people, how we show up, how we approach the world, okay? And when you were born, Virgo was rising, right? So people would call you, we would call you a double Virgo, meaning there's a lot of Virgo energy, right? And so just based on that, right, I talked about the moon and the sun being in opposite signs. Well, the sun is bolstered by, you have the planet Mercury, you have the planet Jupiter, and you have the planet Saturn, all in Virgo. So you have a big Virgo contention, meaning a lot of life, right? You were, your parents were professors, right? This is Virgo energy. So, right, there's a lot of pushing you in this direction. And my sense, looking at the chart, the question that came up for me is how are you integrating the more imaginative spiritual side that's quite powerful in your symbolism in your chart?
That is a very good question, and I am surprised by the accuracy of what your chart seemed to have come back with. Like, I think that a lot of that kind of like fit together. Like, for me, even I would say the things that you were referring to as kind of spiritual, they're still kind of, for me at least, kind of intellectually based or whatever it is, right? But I tend to find that sense of like my work is based around trying to form that sense of connection. Like, I talked to a college class yesterday, and I was telling them that if you watch Dave Chappelle's Block Party, where he just rides around his little town in Ohio and he's handing out tickets to go to this rap concert to like old white ladies, just dudes that are around the corner, all of this, right? And his basic premise being that he is like the central node and the person that all these people could get along with, and that through him, a room full of people who ordinarily would not hang out with each other are now going to go to New York and to watch this show, you know? And I do think that for me, I have always kind of thought, not necessarily that I'm the person to do it per se, but like with my work, which is, you know, a significant part of what I do, it is based around that idea of the connection of people. And there's the idea that, you know, we actually like each other a little bit more than we give ourselves credit for, like when we just let it happen. Like, you think about it, there ain't that many people in your actual life that you legitimately dislike. You know, like, it comes up every now and then, but when you dislike somebody, that stands out. You're just like, yeah, I can't stand that dude. That don't happen very much. People, by and large, I think, are built to get along. And so I think a lot of what I do professionally, which also, I guess, in a lot of ways is also personally, is around that idea that, like, I kick it with a broad set of people. And everybody says that, but it's not about broad in terms of race. It's about class, you know, what kind of jobs people got, where they're from, you know, all those different things. And that, I think, kind of taps into, or probably speaks to, what I think you're saying was coming back on the chart.
Well, I think it's touching on it. It's touching on it, but I want to press a little bit deeper, because mm-hmm. So again, I mentioned that you and I have similarities in our charts, and one of the similarities is bringing all these planets in is the planet Neptune, which is connected to Pisces. So it's about transcendence. And both of us have Neptune. We're born only 3 years apart. So Neptune takes a long time to move. So similar position in the area of the chart that relates to the home and early environment. And so the way it showed up in my life is I grew up in a very religious family. And we went to the kind of church where people got the Holy Ghost, right? And mm-hmm. So this idea of having a real experience of transcendence, of that the Holy Ghost is real, I learned that early in life, okay? I learned that early in life. And so typically Neptune in the fourth house, I'm curious of what were your early experiences, not necessarily religious, but around spirituality. How did your family deal with, you know, the God, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because my father is the son of a preacher. My mother is the daughter of a deacon, but I grew up in a house where none of those things came up, like religion, church, any of that. That's just not it. My father kind of disavowed all of that stuff as he got older. My mother is now back in the church, but that wasn't what we were doing when I was growing up. And what is always interesting is I always say that I would not say I grew up in a Christian home, but I absolutely grew up in a home with Christian values. Like, yes. The value structure that they have is still coming from that place, even if we are not in the house of worship and all of that stuff. And I think the kind of communal spirit that comes from that was also something that was always a big part of our lives. So, like, if you were to ask me explicitly if it wasn't there, no. But I do think that all the influence of it, we absolutely got, just without the name in the book and, you know, the actual going to church part.
Yeah. Yeah. Funny you say that, because, you know, I mentioned we have a lot in common with this placement. My father's mother is a minister. My mother's mother is a minister too. So I grew up in the church, and when I was young, my mom was in the church, but after her and my dad divorced, she went away and she just sent us to church. But definitely those values are very much at the core of who I am, okay?
Yeah, it's wild how that goes, because that's one thing. People get tired of going to church, but they don't really get tired. It's not like they're tired of all of it, right? Like, there's something that drives them away, but there was always something that hooked them there and stays with you. That's just, you know, overwhelmingly that stuff does good for people, you know?
Yeah, well, this is kind of the point I'm trying to make is that my sense is that this has stayed with you. And what's interesting is we talk about, especially in the African American community, we talk about growing up in the church. And, you know, for me, where I really had issues was when I, you know, when I got in trouble around cannabis, because the African American communities are changing now. I mean, I went to NAACP cannabis task force meeting a couple of years ago. And so realizing that, you know, African American community is starting to embrace cannabis, especially with such a mixed up past. But this idea of using substances to enter altered states is a form of spirituality in the sense that it can lead to transcendence in a positive way, because we can touch, you know, inspiration, kind of see the rise up above and see the big picture. But in a negative way, people can use alcohol, substances, et cetera, to escape. Okay. And so I'm curious, right, is in your life, how do you let go? How do you access your imagination? How do you let go of things when they're really bothering you? Because one of the things about Virgo is this striving for perfection. So this constant awareness of where we can be better.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting for me because I would say like the striving toward perfection I got in me, right? But like my mother is a bit of a perfectionist, and I couldn't really live with that as I was younger. Because when you're younger and you feel like it ain't never good enough, it becomes a bit of a problem. And so I feel, at least me personally, I do a decent job of the striving part and understanding that you're seeking a destination that you may not reach. Like it's almost like a Buddhist type of thing, right?
Yes.
Like you're trying to get to a place that you know you're not going to get, but it's the value in, you know, just making the attempt and going in that direction. Now, I would like to note that I still work for a mouse, so every now and then I need to be careful about such things. But I would say that in terms of certain measures of letting go, like for example, when I'm in Las Vegas, I gamble.
Yes.
I do what's legal in the places where things are legal. You know, so if you take me to a place where we can let go in a legal sort of way, okay, I'm down for that. That's the best way to put it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean that's a great that's a great way to manage this opposition I'm talking about, because part of Virgo, what you're talking about is rule following. But there's external rules and there's our own internal rules. All right. And it's funny, the way you described it is almost exactly the way that I describe it when I'm talking to a Virgo. All right. Because here's the thing about Virgo, the virgin, right? The idea of purity. It has nothing to do with sex, but it has to do with this idea of purity or perfection. And so Virgo always has high ideals, right? This is how it should be. Okay. But Virgo's an earth sign and it's associated with humility. So it's about humble self-appraisal to get a sense of where am I right now. And so Virgos are constantly aware of the gap between where I should be and where I am. And what I tell all of them is to realize you're here to strive for perfection, but knowing you're never going to reach it. It's honoring your craft, right? Here's a story I tell to Virgos, and all of them, every time I tell it, they sit there and shake their head, okay? I make it simple. I say there's a carpenter, okay? And he makes high-end desks for you know, rich CEOs. And he gets a call from a CEO who says, you know, my best friend has this wonderful desk. I need one. So he says, yeah, it'll take me 6 months. You can come pick it up on this date, okay? 6 months goes by. The desk is great. It's beautiful. Carpenter lives only a couple of blocks from his workshop, goes to bed that night, right? His client is going to come pick up the desk the next morning. And he's sitting there in his bed, and he's tossing and turning, and he's thinking about one of the edges on that desk, right? It could be, no one is going to notice, but it could be just a little bit smoother, okay? And he tries to convince himself that it'll be fine. No one will notice, but he can't. So he gets up about 2 a.m, gets in his car, drives over to the workshop, and spends about 2 hours just getting that edge just right, okay? A couple hours later, the client comes in to pick up the desk. Client doesn't realize that he spent all that time, but our carpenter, right, feels better about himself, right? Feels better about himself because he didn't let it slide. And to me, that's the heart of Virgo. It's balancing ceaseless effort, because that awareness of how things can be better is not ever going away, with self-love. And what I mean by that is the love of your craft, the love of your craft. Okay. And, you know, again, you know, looking on Wikipedia, I see that you started in a different direction, you know, economics. Okay. And then how did you move from economics to sports journalism?
I got a little nudge called flunking out of grad school.
Yes.
I did not pass one of my qualifying exams. And so after that, I was like, okay, I always wanted to do media stuff, and I've been writing and doing music criticism and stuff like that before. Before I got into grad school. And so from there, I just went full on into the sports stuff. So I had already made relationships with people at ESPN by that point, and that's my first run with them when I wrote for the website from 05 to 07. And so I just literally poured myself into that. And it's interesting. I was thinking about that as you were talking about like the perfectionism element, because while I think I do a good job of like keeping peace with the fact that you're always going to want to be better and sometimes it's not going to be better, when I write, what you talk about with the dude going back to sand down that edge, that's when it comes out. Like, I could never write for a living again because I spend all the time thinking about, like, I get done with it. I think I'm done. I send it in. And then after I send it in, I'm going back over it again just in case I need to change this one thing. And then I'm looking at it, and then I'm coming back, and then I'm waiting. And then when they don't tell me something soon enough, I get anxious. It's like the only thing that like really brings that place out of me. But like all the Virgo that you described, that all comes up if I've got something to write.
Yeah.
Like, and that is that's the biggest place where I notice it.
Yeah. And so the planet of writing is Mercury. And so the Mercury is in Virgo too, right next to your sun. And so it would make sense. And so there's something we call houses. Okay. Houses represent, from an astrology perspective, it tells us where the planets were at a certain time of day. Okay. The signs tell us where the planets were at a certain time of year, the houses day. And what they correspond to is areas of life that the learning is going to take place. Okay. And so your sun is an area of life that has to do with learning to let go. A spiritual house where we learn often how to deal with failure. And so you said failing out, right? And so the story around this area of the chart is, and it's a spiritual area. So we're here for a larger purpose. But if we forget that larger purpose and try to cling on to a lower purpose, that lower purpose will be ripped out of our life so that we wake up to this. And so you kind of talked about it really fast, but I'm curious, what was that experience like of having to let go of a dream, right? Because I've done a little bit in academia and I realize, you know, a master's degree is a challenge, but that the PhD, that's next level, you know? And I'm guessing your parents had PhDs, were professors, like letting go of that dream. Was that easy? Was it hard? What was that like?
Well, it's interesting because in a lot of ways for me, I viewed the PhD as kind of a means to an end for like adding credibility to like commentary and stuff that I wanted to do. Like really for me, writing was the dream. That was, you know, but at the same time, there's an ego component that goes along with this. And I had been the smartest person in the room in just about every room that I had been in. And then I went to graduate school for my master's when I was in California, and I got there and it looked like I was the smartest person in the room there. And then I got to UNC to do the PhD, and some of them might even say that I was the smartest person in the room there, but I was not the best student, and I was not the best economist. And when that got hard, I didn't realize, one, that it was so hard for everybody else, but I had never done anything like this and it had been hard. I had no idea what to do. Like I had, you know, I didn't know how this went. I didn't understand the concept of studying hard just because you study hard. Because I was just like, all right, I always knew the stuff, right? Yeah. And then I hit the wall, and it was like, oh man, I don't have this. I am not. I worked at the time as hard as I could. But it was really, really tough on me as it was going, and I knew that this wasn't going well, and I wasn't even enjoying what I was doing. You know, it was like all those things came together. And then when I, you know, got the notice that it was time for me to go on about my business, my parents were very reassuring, because my biggest fear was that people would look at me differently, as though they had put all this faith in me, and now I have failed this test, and I have not validated what people have been saying about me forever. And they didn't view it like that at all. And so when I left that, I was at peace. Like I expected that the first fall would come and I would miss being in school because I'd always been in school. And now I was good there. Now, when ESPN.com did not renew my contract in 2007, that was the dream, really. Like I had set out at a point, I was like, I'm going to get on staff at ESPN.com's page too. and I even had to throw a temper tantrum at one point kind of to get it or anything else, but I got on, and then they told me that I was not ready for it, and I haven't worked a full-time writing job since then.
Yeah.
That one was rough. It really took me at least about 10 years to legitimately get my confidence back. Like, I wrote a story in the summer of 2020 for Vanity Fair, and a big part of why I did it was for myself, because I needed to affirm to myself that I could write something of the quality of a magazine like Vanity Fair. Because I had thought, you know, 13 years before that I was not good enough to do that, and I would never be good enough to do that.
Yes.
And then I was. Like, that was the big thing for me, was that I never stopped writing, but I stopped writing full time. But I got better. And like, if I was ever proud of myself or something, it was about actually being able to write that thing. Not even necessarily, like, in part, being able to write it and it being good enough to exist in the magazine. But even for me, saying, yeah, I'll do it, you know? Like, I'll go ahead and do this, because there's a chance I could have done it and it would have stunk and I'd have been horribly embarrassed.
Yeah, facing the fears. So as I'm hearing you speak about this, it's obvious that your craft is writing. And are you doing a lot of writing now?
I write in different ways now. Like, I do short commentaries once a week, and that involves writing. Like, television and radio is the work I do, and I really do, like, pour over it. I mean, podcast now, not radio, but, like, I really do, like, put a lot of work into it and want it to be good. But the thing, I think you're right, that brings out all those other things that really gets to a point of craft,
yeah,
is writing stuff. Yeah. And I don't do it as much as I should, because, you know, I just don't have as much time as I did before. But if I have to write something, if you tell me to go, like, right now, in 15 minutes, I got to get on CNN, and I've got to talk about whatever's in the news today. I haven't even looked at the news today, but I'll get on there and I'll do it. Like, I can say right now, I'll go ahead and do that. If you ask me to write something, I am going to go deep into everything within me, because that goes to a different place.
Can you talk more about that? And just for me, you know, our mutual friend, Dan Lebatard, and Dan, when he would write, he would always talk about, you know, this soul-wrenching process of,
yeah,
of what is that?
So here's part of writing, and I'll use the most extreme example, which is if you're going to write a book, right? So, like, I once worked on a book proposal, and the book proposal required writing a sample chapter of a book. And this is what that process felt like. It felt to me like I just wrote something that is the best thing that I have ever written before. And now I'm going to hand it to somebody whose job is to tell me how good it's not, right? Like, I think this is great. And now it's time for somebody to hack it up and tell you that it's not. And then you get it. And then the first time you look at it, you're a little mad, like it hits you in the chest a little bit. But then you look over it and you realize that all that stuff that they said is right. And you can go through and make their changes and then put in some changes yourself that you've noticed off what they do, and then you can hand that to somebody else to read it, and they're going to hack it to death like you didn't even, like the first person didn't even do it. Like, you're just a significant part of that process to get better is finding out what you did wrong.
Yeah.
And so with Dan, he and I have talked about it, and his thing is he's always just whittling away, just sharpening. And when I used to write, I just like to write in energetic bursts, right? Like, oh, I got this thing on this topic. I'm going to throw down everything I can in an hour and a half, sort it around because I felt like it had an energy to it or whatever. But when you're really doing something that's got to be good, it's that feeling of, oh, man, this is great. And now I got to go in there and, like, actually, I don't think this is good at all. But what you wind up with is better.
Yeah.
But you have to kind of beat yourself up a little bit, like it's boxing in that, yeah, sense, right? Like, part of getting ready for the fight is breaking yourself all the way down to then build yourself back up from the ground up.
Yeah.
And then after that, you're putting it in front of people. And I know for me that, like, when I send something out after I've written it and it's submitted to the world, I generally do not care what you people think. Like, I don't even mean that in a confrontational, you know, kind of dismissive, defensive sort of sense. It's just like, no, some people are going to like you, some people are not. These are just the breaks. You know, this is how it goes. You can't get too caught up in it. But when I write, I want you to think it was good. Like, if you don't like my radio show, that's one thing, whatever. You know, if you don't like my TV show, okay, cool. But when I write, I want you to think that it's good. And that's the one place where I will experience a measure of anxiety, that when I put it before people, like, I wonder how this is going to go over. You know,
yeah.
like that writing, just writing takes you to that place. It is permanent. Like, if even in this digital space where it's on a site or whatever, it feels permanent. Like, it's always going to be there. Like, I do a TV show. Nobody's going to watch that show again.
Yeah.
I write something. Somebody's going to pull that up forever and ever and ever.
It's more permanent. Yeah. So, I mean, when did you first notice this passion or this intrigue with writing?
I started writing I was 19. It was the summer after my junior year of college. And so what happened was, my best friend just passed away in the middle of the night my junior year of college in April.
Best friend.
And my plan was to go back to campus and finish the semester, but we came back from the funeral. I drove on campus. I went to my room. I got my stuff. I got in the car, and I went to my parents' house. Yeah. And took incompletes for the whole semester. And then to kill time, this is when Amazon was first hot in the streets. You know, this idea that all the books in the world were on this website.
Yeah.
And so I just went on Amazon and I would order a couple of books and then I'd read them. And then halfway through the second one, I'd order a couple more. And I read a book by Chuck D called Fight the Power, Race, Rap, and Reality. And he talked about how the importance and the need for music critics to be well-versed in rap, and that we had critics in the space who were of the hip hop generation and were not talking about it like tourists, basically. And I was like, wow, that's a great point. And then I read another book by a very highly respected writer who I won't name about hip hop. And I thought the book was terrible. And I thought to myself, if y'all are telling me that this guy is one of the biggest deals in the street, I was like, well, shit, I can do this. And so then I started writing. And I was like, I had all this time and I was going through all this stuff. And I found a website where, if you posted something and somebody read it, you would get 5 cents every time somebody read something. And then when you got up to $50, they send you a check. You know, I was like, oh, okay, cool, I'll do this. And so I started sending it out and writing. And then a few people would tell me it was good. Like, they told me it was professional quality good, which I didn't believe. And then once I did that, I decided, okay, I'm going to be a writer. So, like, basically most of my senior year of college was just, I would sit at the computer and I would get on the internet and I would look for stuff to write. Like, look up stuff, just see if something that was going on there. I decided I want to do music is when Napster first got popping. I just download music and listen to music so I can learn about music and then go write about music. Like, I just leaned all the way into it because I had a big hole in my life. I needed to fill it, and I filled it with that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny that it was triggered by loss. You know, this is the 12th house where the sun is. You know, hearing you say that, I'm curious. I want to go a little bit deeper into this. So when you say good, and for you, when you're writing something, what are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to elicit in the reader?
Like, the most interesting part of the process for me is figuring out what angle it is that I want to take and what point it is that I want to leave you with. Because the one thing about it is, I can't write something. I'm not going to spend my time writing something and waste your time reading something that's obvious. Like, if the point is abundantly clear and you don't need anybody else to tell you, then you don't need me to tell you. Like, I just hate people who write obvious stuff. That's never going to be the thing. What I hope to do is to put things really as plainly as possible in a way that helps people understand whatever the topic is in a way that they may not have considered or something they had not talked about. And my brother made a point to me when I first started writing that I'll never forget, and it's like a guiding principle of what I do. And he says, never forget that a good argument is not an argument that a genius can't refute. It is an argument that a fool can't refute. Like, I want to put this so plainly and so clearly and so indisputably that even if you are disingenuous in your response, you will not be able to deny what is being said. It will be that true. Not necessarily that right, but it will be that true. That's really what I'm going for.
Wow. So how do you judge truth? Is it when you read what you wrote and you see, does it resonate? Like, how do you judge truth?
Yeah, so when I'm reading back over it, I'm looking for what is the question. Like, what question could you ask based on this paragraph that I've written, right? And if there are if I see a question that comes with a big answer that needs to be dealt with, then we need to go back in there and we need to deal with that part already, right? Because that's if somebody's got a fair question, let's go ahead and do that. So I am trying as best as I can. Like, in economics, thing I learned in the PhD program is basically, how to reduce an equation to parameters, right? We want to eliminate all the things that are variable. We want to get them out of there and try to figure this out in the simplest terms that we possibly can that are always going to exist in the mathematical system. And so with writing, there's an influence of that comes in. And what I'm trying to get it down to is things that we can all agree on, like kind of factual tenets that we could all agree on, and keep as close to those as possible. So it's not just simply about I'm not just trying to interpret what's going on here. I'm really trying to deconstruct what it is. And if we keep it as simple as possible there, then I think we get to the truth of what it is, right? So it's not simply like, this is my opinion and here's why my opinion is right. I mean, that'll be there in part, but the foundation of it, I always hope, is something so simple and basic and foundational that we can all agree on it, whether we want to or not.
Yeah. So that feels similar to my definition of spiritual, right? Because to me, spiritual is where there's some oneness. And when we can all agree on something, it means we're tapping into something that's universal. And so this is fascinating. One of the things in your chart, in the house, is the third house, and it's about communication. It's about finding your voice, okay? And so anyone that has a planet in the third house, the issue in their life about finding their voice becomes prominent. And when I say finding your voice, it really starts with acknowledging the way that you actually see the world, okay? And because when we're taught a way to see the world, right? Our parents, our family, we're conditioned on how to see the world. But yeah, planets in the third house, it means the way you were taught to see the world is not actually the way that you see the world, okay? And for you, the planet is Uranus, okay? And Uranus represents the principle of individuation. Individuation. And individuation means this is what I've been trained to do, but I have a sense that who I really am is something different. Okay. And so in this area of the chart, it's saying that one of the things you're learning to do in this lifetime is share unpopular opinions. Okay. And what I mean by that is it's like, and you mentioned the word genius. My definition of genius in this context is that unique perspective that only you have based on your experiences, right? And so it's our uniqueness in the group, right? And in order to function in the world, we all have to do kind of groupthink, right? We have to trust that when I get to a stoplight, everyone is going to stop when it's red and everyone's going to go when it's green. And so we need groupthink to function as a culture. But if you think of how much groupthink, right, fitting in has silenced us, you know, the fear to share an unpopular opinion, especially when it's actually how you see the world. And you know, when you're working for ESPN, right, and they have, especially recently with, you know, becoming less political, and that it seems like working for a big corporation can put confines on that process of sharing unpopular opinions. And so I'm curious, how have you wrestled with you know, wanting to speak truth? And again, I think on one level what you spoke to is truth that everyone can agree on, right? But that Uranus makes me think, how do you share your individual truth?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because I think where you see some of the similarities between us, I don't have the chart with me, but I see some similar, like, in background and stuff. And one thing that I remember reading about you talking about with yourself is just kind of feeling comfortable in the rooms that you were in. Like, I think I read one story where you said you felt at times that, like, you could be too black for your white friends and too white for your black friends, and so where do you go? Now, that was not my exact struggle, but I think it is parallel to the point I'm going to make, which is my background is fairly unique in a way that I'm not sure there's a room that I, like, actually fit in, right? Yeah. And so I'm comfortable in all of them because I don't fit in any of them. Right. Like, I'm just going however it happens to be, I'm going to happen to be in that space and then go there. And so over time with that, I have found that for whatever reason, even though some people are going to get mad at some of the stuff I say, I've always felt comfortable saying things that might not be that popular, because for whatever reason, people are willing to listen to me in a way that honestly, maybe they shouldn't, you know, but I've like, I always feel that people are willing to give me a little latitude in some ways and times that they may not. Like, there are people who would listen to me say certain things that they would never listen to anybody else say. Like, they could hear it out from me. They could never hear it out from Barack Obama. And I go way farther than Barack Obama ever did when it comes to talking about these things. And I think for me, the key to sharing, at least that way I feel, is when I'm sharing something that I think might be unpopular to somebody, is it ain't personal. And like, if at best I can express to them that what I'm saying is not personal, it's about them, like this is shared and this is mine and this is rational, I'm being as fair as I possibly can, then I always feel comfortable that I'll be able to do it. And then there's always going to be crazy people, right? Like, crazy people are going to jump up and say whatever they say in these places. You know, they don't know how to act. They are just purging their anger. I've learned to figure out what about that is not about me.
Yeah.
Like, what about that happens to be about them? But I've been lucky. People treat me with respect when I do those things. Like, even within ESPN, like, I've never had them come talk to me about anything, about, like, tone this down or anything. And this year has been interesting because when George Floyd happened, we were on top of it. And like with my podcast, our numbers went through the roof at that point, and we kept the people afterward, and everybody was confused because they, you know, they had been told that this is what was scaring the people away.
Yeah. Yeah. This is okay. So now we're getting to something. So do you sense the pressure from ESPN? Like, have you had radical thoughts that you had to rein in? That's what I'm trying to ask.
No, anything that I've ever reined in, it was my own decision that I did for myself. Right. Like, if there's something that I've decided, like for me, there's no point in putting the thought out there if people can't hear it. Like Bill Withers had a great line, it don't do too much good to be talking, brother, if ain't nobody listening. Right. So there can be perhaps radical thoughts that if I don't think I'm in a position to present them in a way that they can actually be digested, then I'm gonna fall back off of it. But it's not necessarily because I fear consequence or fear what might happen. But I'm not just doing it so you can say that I said it. Nobody wins in that regard.
Well, here's where I'm going to push back a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's some things that are said in the present moment that are ahead of their time, meaning right, people aren't ready to hear them. But the fact that they were said or put down in the future when people were ready to hear them, it was there for them. It was there for them.
Yeah. Like, I will say this. I am fairly critical of capitalism as an idea, and I do it like in all the places where I am. I'm surprised nobody come to shut that down yet. Like, that's the one place where people are like, hey, hold on now. That's what we do.
Yeah. 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 Because, you know, and there's interesting symbolism in the chart, and the chart suggests that, you know, in the past there were situations where you were shut down for being a little bit too radical in maybe in subtle ways, right? Where it's the subtle message we get from other people that maybe it's not okay to go there. Because I look at your chart, and the chart says that and you're doing it. I want to honor that. But in this lifetime, you're here to say something radical, right? And this idea of the thought might be, if I say this, people aren't ready for it. People can't hear it. But when you actually say it, you surprise people, right? People were shocked that they were ready to hear it.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting thought. And also, it is entirely possible that things I don't think are radical to other people, right? Like, I may not even necessarily have the best gauge on how radical something is that I have or have not offered. I mean, some people can make the argument that just kind of my existence in the space in a lot of ways is just being here and being like this.
Yes.
Is fairly radical to people. But I don't. Yeah, it's just always big to me that I will not ever operate on the basis of fear in ways of doing this job. Like, not that I'm not that there aren't things to fear or nothing to be afraid of or whatever it is, but I do feel like I'm not afraid of the truth, you know? And I have believed that if what I'm saying is true, then I'll ultimately be okay. Like, I had this situation came up once. I wore this t-shirt that was a takeoff of the Cleveland Indians logo, but instead of a skinning, grinning Indian on it, it said Caucasians, and it had a blonde-headed white dude on it. And that set the internet on fire. It set the world on fire. Everybody was all riled up, or a lot of people were riled up. And to me, that wasn't radical. To me, it was just kind of, I thought the shirt was funny,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
Oh, but it apparently was radical to quite a few people. What's funny is I know people at my job had a problem with it, but nobody said anything to me.
Interesting. And so how was that pushback? Was it just, you know, kind of wiped it off, or did you take it seriously, or?
Most of the response was actually fairly positive, because like, it was one of those things where people were mad, but they didn't know why they were mad. Yeah. They just knew they were mad. Yeah. Like, they just knew that something didn't add up. Like, the joke's not supposed to be on the white man, and that confused them. And yes. But they couldn't figure out how to articulate it.
Yes.
And so, like, for a lot of people, I became like a hero to them. Like, and a lot of Native American brothers and sisters were very appreciative of it. And I wish I could say that I had this grand plan, but I did not. It just kind of like stumbled into it. But the people who were mad, they weren't making any sense you know? And then once they weren't making any sense, I was like, oh, okay, whatever, you got it. Like, yeah. this isn't something I can worry about.
Yeah. I had a similar experience when I retired from the Dolphins in 2004 and traveling the world doing my thing, and people had problems, and my experience was they didn't make sense, right? That at least to me, my rationale of what I was doing, and I was happy for the first time in a long time that I was like, I'm not worried about
yeah.
that.
Well, you had that dream life, right? Like, people can't imagine that if you were doing something that they want to do, that you would ever stop doing it, no matter what that thing happens to be. Like, when people, you know, somebody decides they're going to retire from making music, nobody can understand it, right? Because yes. they're like, I would love to make music. Why would you stop?
It's the truth. So let's talk about sports now. You know, as a member of the media, how much of a response, like, who do you feel the responsibility towards? Yourself, the athletes, the fans? Where do you feel your responsibility lies?
You know, one, there's the truth part, right? Like, I think there's a responsibility toward that, and that part serves everybody. When I'm discussing college athletics, I absolutely feel we have a responsibility for the players. I think they are not in a position to help themselves. They do not have agency over themselves. I think that we in the media, in this job, part of our job, even if the point is just to tell the truth is to protect in a lot of ways for them. Like, I feel that in particular. And with the pros, as I get older, I feel more of a responsibility toward the players, because what I did not have a grasp of was how young they were.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just turned 40. We're talking about dudes 23, 24, 25 years old in a lot of cases. And we're expecting, honestly, a lot of them, given their unique circumstances and the ages that they are at the time of doing it. You know, like, I think that, and particularly being black and knowing who a lot of the people are that cover these guys, that to be fair to them is very, very important, because so many people are often unfair to them as a result. So, like, I feel a responsibility there. And I feel a responsibility toward the listeners or readers or whoever it is that consumes my content, because a big part of why they do is because they trust me. And so I need that trust is more valuable than anything else, right? That people believe that when I talk, I mean what I say. And that even if I get something wrong, it is coming from an honest place. Maintaining that is more important than anything else. And that's important to me also, like, with the athletes, because I'm not a guy that's in the locker room all the time, right? I get on TV, I talk about people that in very many cases I'll never meet or I have never seen before. It can be real easy to get real comfortable and say a lot of wild stuff yeah. about people yes. under those circumstances. And yeah. I realized early, like when I was doing local radio, I'd say all kinds of stuff that I wouldn't say national. You know why? Because they don't hear you when you do local radio. That's like talking to your friends. You know, when you get on ESPN, they're hearing it. They're consuming it. And I have to be fair to those people. Because in the end, one day somebody, and this happens, man, somebody going to call you or somebody going to come up to you and ask you to say that again. And if you can't say it again, you're the one with a problem. And so I make sure that anything I'm going to do or say is something that I can and will say again if asked.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mentioned that Virgo's associated with the critic. And so I'm curious, what is your definition of a critic?
That's a good question, because I don't think the critic necessarily, like, has to have a negative connotation, right? I can be critical of things that I admire. Like, I'm the biggest Prince fan in the world. But Prince put out a few records that I think we need to act like didn't happen before, right? If you were to ask me what I didn't like about this or what I didn't like about that, I can do that. Like, I think the role of the critic is to give context and to help, like, through your own evaluation of something, help people see things in a way that they may not have. And I think that there's a value in that, assuming you don't believe your job is by definition to be negative. And, like, once that happens, you're in a bad place.
Yeah, I mean, the definition of critique or critic isn't negative, but it's kind of turned that way because it's uncomfortable to be critiqued, right? In a negative way, and it feels good to be critiqued in a positive way. Journalism, right? Journalism. Okay, different question. What do you think is you said context. What gives you the confidence in your way of viewing things that it's has value to other people?
Interestingly, I think that the confidence to do that comes from the recognition that in the end, I'm just one person with one set of thoughts, you know, and I have been affirmed by the responses that I've received from people about the thoughts as I've shared them over time. But like Charles Barkley, for example, for better or worse, Charles will tell you what he thinks, right? And it's not because Charles Barkley thinks he's the smartest man in the world. It's because Charles Barkley thinks he's just a dude who's allowed to say what he thinks.
Yeah.
You know, you're allowed to say what you think.
Yeah.
You go ahead and do it. And that's like, I really believe we've all got a right to do that. And so for me, I had people who told me like, oh, I found this thing interesting that you had said. And through my life, people have found it interesting when I started talking about stuff. And so that continued and I rolled with it.
That's a profound statement coming from a black man, you know, especially in the you know, the past year and a half, what's been going on in the world and this idea of black, to me, black voices, right. Black voices matter. And I think so much of where we've all come from, it's just been a Eurocentric West. And as you know, as we kind of grown up in this and trying to own our own confidence, right? And I think especially when we speak up, you know, part of the legacy of slavery was we weren't allowed to be educated, right? And so
right. Well, let me tell you this, what's interesting. I went to school growing up in a town called Waller, Texas, population 1,493. It's the town over from Prairie View, because my parents worked at Prairie View when I was growing up. And that ain't no bastion of liberalism there, right? Like, that's where Sandra Bland died in jail, was in Waller County. Like, this is the place we're talking about. But even there, even the white folks that I went to school with, they always listen when I talk. Like, I know stories, like, firsthand of people who were kind of destroyed by their educational system that went out of their way to like dim the light of really smart black dudes, right? Yes. I don't know if it's just because of the support I have from my parents to make sure that never happened, but that was the one thing I have to say about the place that I grew up going to school. That never happened. Like people really, they always treated me not just like I was like a person to listen to, but like I was somebody to listen to.
Yeah.
And then looking back, I like it's kind of crazy to think of like the real world actually let me down after the way I had been treated in this little town in Texas.
How do you understand that?
You know, it's interesting looking back because at the time, you know, the 90s were a pretty optimistic time for a lot of us when we talk about race and stuff like that, right? Like we just wear cross colors, racism hurts everybody, the rap was in the streets, you know, like it was the first, I think the 90s was the first decade post-civil rights movement that we really thought we might get this thing like going in the right direction about that stuff. And so like I look back on it and I was, I guess, naive in some ways about what the world really was. And I could probably go back and look and find some things that were a bit worse than I realized they were at the time. But like in my, you know, high school and graduating class, I wasn't a valedictorian or anything, but people by and large recognized me as like that dude when it came to smart stuff. Like if there's somebody, something that people didn't know when they need to ask somebody, I was the person they asked. And that didn't matter if they were black, white, they mean other kids in the gifted class, like all of that. And I don't think I'm just that damn brilliant necessarily, but for whatever reason, I was able to traffic in that space with a broad set of people who respected me for whatever it was that I was doing. And I do like hear the stories that my friends tell about going to school and stuff like that. And I do not know why it was so different for me, but I definitely was.
Yeah. So there's a couple of ideas that I pulled from your chart. So the planet Jupiter, is about confidence, and it's where we have to learn to believe in ourselves. Okay. And your Jupiter is in the area of the chart that when you walk into a room, whether you're aware of it or not, you exude this Jupiter, this energy. And I would say, looking at the biography of your life, that it comes from the support from your parents, right? Is that you knew probably more than other African Americans to have faith and confidence in your intelligence, right? That it was something that was valued in the home. Because again, Jupiter is where we have to believe in ourselves. In Virgo, right? You believe in your ability to learn. You believe in your ability to figure things out. And you just exude that confidence. And Jupiter is preacher energy. And preacher in the sense of someone who shares their beliefs confidently. Okay? Another word we have for this is opinions, right? Opinions. In Virgo, well-informed opinions that you feel comfortable putting out in the world, and that attracts people projecting onto you that you have the answers, right? But there's pressure that comes with that.
Yeah, I think one interesting thing that my parents did that proved to be more helpful than I would have ever recognized at the time, and I think this is really important for Black children in their development, is at a very early age to have a handle and understanding of African history. So like before we got on the boats type of stuff. Because if your concept of Blackness only starts in the United States, then it starts in this position of subjugation. If you start from Africa, you just have a broader range of experience that you're talking about with people. You know, like I'm not big into the we was kings and queens type talk, but there is something to be said for recognizing these are the amazing things that Black people have done all the way through time. And if you start there, I don't think you ever get to that place where you doubt yourself based on your Blackness, which is real easy to do because this whole society is telling you to do that. You know, it's not even about one individual person that's doing it to you. It's a whole world that's telling you that. And so the one thing I really look at it with my parents, I'm like, that was the best thing for it, is if you start from a position of viewing Blackness as a good rather than an impediment, that goes a long way in how you wind up seeing yourself and seeing the world.
Well, and I think you spoke to it, the role of parents in that, because things are changing, but when we grew up, most of the messages we received outside of the home was contrary. It was that Black wasn't good. And so I think it's important it is up to community and parents to start to instill this truth. It's a truth. You know, the interesting coincidence here, I had a conversation yesterday. I did a reading last week for an attorney who does trade work in Africa. And going to Africa, he's connected to a couple of chiefs. And so, you know, I mentioned to him that, you know, I have a vision for creating something that allows African Americans in the United States to have a cultural program where they get to we take them to Africa and they get the real experience of the homeland and they get to see it for themselves. And for that same reason, you know, I think about this often. As an African American, our history is rooted in slavery, right? That's our history, right? That's where it starts. And yeah, you know, I think something they said, it was such a profound conversation. I felt like it was Zoom, but I felt like I was taken home for that hour. And you know, we went through like the libation, a prayer, earliest form of prayer. And I just felt through this interaction like this, that there is something missing in the African American narrative. And I think what you're speaking to is really at the core of it.
Yeah, no, that point is that if your point of origin in your belief of your experience starts at slavery, you can't win.
Yeah. Wow. The last thing I want to talk about is, you know, after playing some time in the NFL, you know, and I won't call it a regret, but one of the things that I think about and consider, you know, would I have been better served at a historically Black college or university? And most of the time when I ask that question, I the answer is yes. The answer is yes. And I just, my experience of, even though I did a lot of wonderful things at the University of Texas, it was in a lot of ways, it was a very disempowering and alienating experience, because the message that I received unconsciously was my only value was that, you know, I can run on the football field. And culturally, I felt almost starved, you know. I had a conversation with a friend of mine, grew up in California, and you know, he went to Howard. He went to Howard for 2 years. And I was sitting here and he was telling me his stories, and I was sitting there almost in tears, realizing a golden opportunity that I missed to be held through this process. And I think the collegiate football process, just that college, it's the gateway from childhood essentially into adulthood. And I think it's such a pivotal time for young men and women in life that, again, I feel like I missed an opportunity. And I think to a certain extent, I could have had the same success in the NFL if I had that same level of productivity at a HBCU.
Yeah, you know, you're an interesting case because you were just so damn good that I think wherever you went, it probably would have ended up the way that it wound up going. I still, like, even to this day, I still can't believe they got you to go from San Diego to Austin. Like, I was just like, wow, a great trick. And you didn't just do it. You did it to play for John Makovic. Like, man, like, that must have been a hell of a weekend when they got you down there.
That's funny.
But, yeah. And for people who don't know, I'm a graduate of Clark Atlanta University and HBCU. My mother graduated from University of Oklahoma. My father is HBCU graduate. My parents both worked at HBCUs for basically my whole life. And I think for you as a man, an HBCU would have been great, because I think what was great for me about going to a black college, even with the things I talk about with, learning the origins of black people and everything else, there's a diversity at the black college that people don't realize, because they think of diversity just about being different skin tones. But seeing the full range of black people, and that there's room for every type of black person, So you in 1995 could have showed up at a black college with those same dreads and a nose ring. And guess what? There's another one of these right over here, right? Like, you just, it's just all these people from all these places. And I think for a lot of people, this happens where there's a comfort that they develop with their blackness, because if you are black and you grow up around white people, you are very often apprehensive and fearful that those black people are going to reject you because you did not grow up in the ways that they did. When in reality, there's actually somebody who is just like you who also grew up around a bunch of black people. Like, it's just a wild thing in the way that it plays out. And so I always feel that as people, HBCUs are generally better for black students. And another part is it can be very difficult for white people, because they grew up in all this madness like we did, to believe in the potential of our greatness. So an example of this is that I haven't seen the numbers in a while, but historically, more black people go to white schools than go to HBCUs in raw numbers. But HBCUs vastly disproportionately produce more PhD students, like graduate students from the HBCU. Because if you're going to become a college professor or do the PhD, what normally happens is a professor notices something about a student and then comes and basically invites them into the club, because nobody decides they want to do that on their own, really. It comes from the encouragement of your mentors and your advisors to decide that you're going to take that path. And that just typically doesn't happen for black students with white professors. They just don't see us that way. And so the HBCU is a great nurturing environment for black people, because we have eliminated a significant part of the problem for a lot of us, which is racism. Even if it's just for a little period of time, and you're going to deal with some different hassles, like the problem I have with recommending to athletes that they go to HBCUs if they have real professional endeavors is just that the facilities and everything else that we got just ain't really up to snuff. It's not the same. Like, if you're going somewhere to play football, I recommend you go to the place that'll be best for you to play football. But I also could understand, like, if somebody's really that dude and they turn, like, I remember when I was in middle school, I remember when Strahan was at Texas Southern. He had like 20 sacks one year or something like that. Like, it was just comedy. It was absolutely. I remember when McNair was at Alcorn. I watched him play against Prairie View when Prairie View didn't have scholarship players. And you could imagine what a bloodbath that was. And them dudes got to where it was that they were going. And I'm not sure that Steve McNair's career turns out differently if he goes to Mississippi State or Southern Miss or Ole Miss rather than going to Alcorn. I don't know. I don't think Strahan's career turns out differently if he's at Texas playing with Shane Dronette instead of playing at Texas Southern. I don't know if it goes in those ways. Like, I think it might have gone the exact same way for them. So, like, I think it's important for the black schools to be able to produce a competitive product, so that when people are making decisions, they're not just going to the HBCU in the name of a cause. They're going because they legitimately think it's best for them. But I do believe that in terms of nurturing and development and growing up and becoming an adult, that my outcomes would have been vastly different had I not gone to an HBCU.
I can feel it. I can feel it. If I'm being real, I can feel it talking to you. So this is such an interesting topic, because it's where I get stuck. Is I understand the idea in capitalism that if you have an opportunity to make millions of dollars at a young age and take care of your family, that you go for it. My question is, at what cost? At what cost to you as a human being, as a man? Okay. In my own personal life, I reflect back and I look at those costs, and I made a lot of money, but again, what did I sacrifice for that? Right. And I was able, to get back, to some extent what I lost, but I just think of building for the future. And I would love to see, I get tempted to get back into coaching, and I, it would be hard for me to turn down a job at a historically, you know, black college and university. Because I believe in this magic time, 18, 19, 20, 21, that's where leaders are built. And I think football is sports, but football is a great tool to train leaders.
Yeah, and I also think that you have learned this, and it's nothing that anybody wants to hear a rich person say to a person who doesn't have a lot of money, but the money doesn't make you happy like you think it would. It just, that's just not how it works. Like, so if I were to tell you, I'm going to hit you in the head with a baseball bat, but I'm going to give you $1 million after I do, it's still going to feel like you got hit in the head with a baseball bat. You're just going to have $1 million afterward, right? Like, and that part is key. Like, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, and this is a hot take. Being good at stuff is just a little bit overrated. Like, when you think about all the things that people put their kids through at young ages, just hoping they'll be good at something, just for the intrinsic value of being able to say, well, I was really good at basketball, or I was really good at figure skating, or whatever it is, and how many hours of just being a child get lost in the name of becoming good at something. And then we look up and see how many of those people aren't actually happy.
Yes.
You know, so you want your people to be like qualified and trained to function in the world and stuff like that. But I think for a lot of people, they do not see themselves as being good at anything and wish they were. And therefore they will lean in on the idea of their kids like being good at something. But then after you're good at it, then what?
Then what?
Because so many of our heroes and some of the most excellent people lived miserable lives and died unhappy people, but they were good at something.
Yeah. I mean, it speaks to my story. I was on that path of being, you know, arguably making to the Hall of Fame. But I just got to this point where I was like, I had this in the vision. The vision was, what am I doing? I feel like I'm distracting people for a few hours on Sunday. And the vision I got for myself is doing something to give back, right? Doing something that's not just about me. Because I think the value of being successful is that you get to the place where you have a platform to give back. And I think when you haven't made money or you haven't had some level of success where people respect you and are listening to you, there is a feeling where I feel like I don't have enough to contribute. I don't have anything to contribute. And so I think being good and becoming skillful and being successful, right? I think we have to be selfish to get there, but most of us, once we get there, we realize this is not just about me. This is about something bigger. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So last question. What is from what you've experienced and you've seen a lot as a journalist, what would be your message in general to a young African-American man, kid, teenager that came up to you and said, I want to be a professional athlete?
Yeah, I would ask him why. Like, that would be the first question, is why. If it is because you want to achieve a certain lifestyle, which happens, you can do that. But you just need to understand, especially if you want to play football, you are going to make a significant trade in order to live that, right? Like, a lot of people make the decision that they want to have a great life early and they're willing to deal with the pain on the back end. Because I think the one thing that it's impossible, or it used to be impossible, I think it's easier now, but to explain to kids when they first go down that journey is like the physical toll that it's going to take. And they can tell you it's going to be there, but you can't know it until you feel it. It's kind of like people tell you how hard grad school is. You're just like, oh, it's just like college, you know? And then you get there and you're like, this is not like college at all. This is hard as a $50 jawbreaker. I can't believe this.
Yes.
So that would be the one thing I would tell them. The other thing I would tell them is, if you want to be a professional athlete, you're going to have to be the one to develop your brain. Because none of the people who are associated with this have any incentive to develop your brain. You're going to have to take that responsibility. And when they push back at you about it, you're going to have to push back again. If you got to call your parents to have them come do it, then do that too. But you're going to have to take responsibility for your intellectual development, because those guys don't get paid based on your grades. They get paid based on what you do on that field.
Wow. All right. So that was the last one. But similar question. Someone, a teenager, African-American, walks up to you and says, I want to be a professional sports journalist. What do you tell them?
I will tell them what somebody told me when I first got into doing radio. He's like, you'll never get rich doing this, right? I mean, he was wrong, but it was the right statement, right? He was like, you'll never get rich doing this, but if this is what you love, you can love it every day. Mm. And that was something that really hit hard for me and wound up being the truth, right? Like, people are like, don't you get bored talking about sports? Nah, because I haven't gotten bored watching sports. Like, I enjoy marveling at the things that athletes do, and then there's all the side stuff with, like, the business and then the social stuff that comes into it. But I would tell them, don't do this job if you don't like people. Because the job is a people job. And if you don't like people, it will make you miserable. Like, if you know, we got a lot of people out here who hate the people they cover. Like, and, you know, I'm sure you could feel that at times when you're in there. Like, the resentment that a lot of my colleagues feel toward these young, rich dudes who they cover.
So that's and real. So that's
if
real.
If you can't appreciate people, this is not the job for you. Because those are some very interesting people, but they're people, which means they're going to mess up a lot, you know?
So that's real. Like, I mean, because as athletes, we talk about, you know, some of the, like, the salty members of the media that, and we kind of feel like they're just, you know, they're just jealous, or they can't, you know, believe that we make more money in a week than they make in 5 years. That's real, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's real. Let me tell you something I'll never forget. Rick Riley, when he was at Sports Illustrated, wrote a story, and it was kind of funny at the time. Like, it has to be 20, 25 years old. But it was about various athletes who loved to show off their private parts to members of the media, right? And I remember one person that he mentioned in particular was Bruce Smith. And he said Bruce Smith would be at his locker, and there's all these dudes around getting ready. And then Bruce Smith turned around, put his foot up, right? So he's got his, like, one leg straight and one knee up, and he just got it out right there, you know, right there and taking questions. And it was funny because I was reading it, and I was like, oh, Rick, you don't understand what's going on here. He's tired of people trying to sneak and look at it, so he's putting it out there so you guys don't have to do that anymore. Like, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, I totally get what, like, as I got, as an adult and I read it, I was like, no, man, it's a bunch of y'all in here peeping glimpses, and I'm not saying that you're doing it, like, in any, like, I'm not saying anything at all homophobic. It's not about attraction as much as it is literally just this bizarre curiosity,
yes,
you know, about these guys and just wondering, oh, I wonder what it is, or so forth and so on, you know?
Oh my God.
And those things happen, you know, like, it's, and for a lot of them, don't remember this, for a lot of our colleagues, the only black people they know are the ones in the locker room and a couple of them in the press box.
Wow.
That's it. Those are the only ones they know, you know? And so, yeah. If, especially, and if you're a white dude covering sports, I feel like I need to give them the lesson more than anything else. Like, don't make those the only black people you know.
Yeah.
You will be much better at your job if you actually know some black people.
Wow. I didn't even, like, consider that. But, you know, just flashing back to my memory, most of the media members, when I played at least, were interesting that they're covering us. And how the subtle racism comes out. You know, like, one of the things I was sensitive to, you know, anytime a story was written about me, years after I failed a drug test, right? None of that. Years after, they're writing a positive story, right? And they have to remind everyone about that I failed a drug test, and that I was this, and that I was that. And I'm just like, what is this?
Right. Especially now. Like, you know, we ain't even tripping on that no more. You
know what I mean? Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Well, thank you for joining me, Bomani. I know, you know, you're a busy man, so thank you for coming on and talking a little astrology with me.
Hey, man, thanks for having me on. I cannot believe I just let Ricky Williams read my life off of the moon.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, you take care.
Hey, man, you too.
Okay, so I really enjoyed this conversation, and I know I say it every time, but the truth is I love talking astrology, and especially seeing how it interacts in real life, and so I truly do enjoy talking to all my guests. My favorite part of this conversation was when we talked about the experience of going to historically black college or university. And it's something that I mean, obviously from the way I spoke about it, that I've been thinking a lot and reflecting a lot on, thinking about my life. And so to have, you know, this conversation with someone who's had that experience, who grew up around that experience, I got a lot out of that. Other thing, you know, I talked about in the intro, I talked about Virgo and Pisces. And, you know, one of the things that Pisces has to do with is letting go. And by extension, it's also associated with failure. Because sometimes if we don't recognize when it's time to let go, the letting go happens through some kind of failure. And hopefully then we realize, oh, this thing that I failed at or this thing that I let go of is what I needed to let go of so that I could find what's truly meant for me. And in the Wikipedia page, I read about Bomani not finishing his PhD, but to be able to talk about it with him was really cool, and to hear how his parents supported him. And I think that's special. That's special for him to recognize through failure, right, that maybe this isn't what's meant for him. And he was able to find what was, which was that shift into journalism. Because in those, you know, learning about Bomani, I thought it was curious of how he went from a scholar, someone studying politics and economics, to make the jump and the crossover to being a sports journalist. And I suspected, you know, that something must have happened to get him off of one track and to get him on the other track. And it seems to me, I talked about his Pisces moon in the intro. It seems to me that shift in the ability to bring his critic sensibilities to sports and representing African Americans, I think that's the path for him, you know. And again, letting go of the idea of what he thought he was going to do to find his true path. And in my opinion, he's really killing it. And to see someone who's using his voice to tell meaningful stories, to shed light for people, I think that's powerful, powerful journalism. The other thing that I really took from this conversation that I thought was really cool. When Bomani was talking about when he was young, and you know, even though he was African American, I think part of it was bolstered by the fact that both of his parents were college professors. But even still, his classmates in East Texas town, right? His classmates could recognize that he knew stuff. Okay, and in Bomani's chart, he's got the planet Jupiter and the planet Saturn in the first house in Virgo. Okay. And so the first house area of the chart is about the energies that we carry when we show up. We walk into a room, people can feel these vibes coming off of us. And one of the archetypes associated with Jupiter is the know-it-all, right? The person that has the answers. And the other planet, Saturn, in the first house is considered the elder, the people we take seriously. Okay. And even if we have planets in our chart, right, they still show themselves early in life. And so this shows that early in life, he exuded this confidence in his competence, you know, Jupiter in Virgo, which was supported by the fact that both of his parents, professors, which is very Jupiter in Virgo kind of profession, the person that knows it all, who's passing on the information and the lineage. Great conversation. And it's a really cool example of how the astrological archetypes play and they manifest. So, you know, I think of what I would like the listeners to take away from this is what I said earlier, is that, you know, we have an idea of what our path is, and sometimes it doesn't go the way we think it should go. And to stay open to, maybe doesn't mean that there's something wrong with me or something wrong with the path. Maybe it's just not the path that's for me. And utilizing, you know, the opportunity to do something different, to find something that works for you, something that fulfills you and makes you happy. What ideas about yourself, right? This is my mantra question or my affirmation for the day, is what ideas about yourself that are false are you holding on to, that are keeping you from finding and fulfilling what you're really here to do, right? Something to think about and reflect on, and to realize that, again, looking at the positive side of failure is that we're free to find a path that's going to be more fulfilling. Well, thank you for joining me, and I look forward to talking to you next time on Curious Questions with me, Ricky Williams.